From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. This is Here and Now. COVID-19 infections are rising in many states once again. Colorado is among the states to reactivate what are called crisis standards of care. Those are rules that allow hospitals to prioritize staff for emergencies and reduce the level of care for non-emergencies. In addition, Colorado Governor Jared Polis has announced anyone 18 and older can get a vaccine booster shot. Dr. Ivor Douglas has been reckoning with the latest surge. He is chief of pulmonary and critical care medicine at Denver Health. Welcome to Here and Now.
Many thanks for the invitation.
We know that Colorado is experiencing its fifth COVID wave. Could you describe what that's like? Because it almost sounds like one long wave with maybe some easing up in the middle. What is happening there?
What we're experiencing now is really akin to the pandemic wave that hit us prior to the availability of vaccines last November and December, because both in terms of the requirement for hospital services, both for COVID and other diagnoses, as well as the general level of concern in our community. It's almost as if the impact of the vaccine has been intangible, because right now the pandemic is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. What's different this time, and we are also dealing with the fallout and consequence of long-term psychiatric and substance dependence related illnesses, and our ICUs particularly are just overflowing.
Give me an example of what you're talking about, because this is part of where the pressure on the medical system comes in, not just with the infections, as you say, but also people who are affected by the pandemic itself. Could you give us an example?
A substance related severe illness, including lethal overdoses with street fentanyl, has become a challenge that is just devastating and has resulted in numerous deaths of people younger than 35. And then on top of that is the appreciation that for many people, their healthcare maintenance was far from optimal during the height of the pandemic. And even though they're vaccinated, presentations with heart failure and deterioration of breathing is resulting in hospitalization in a way that's quite exceptional.
So when you go into the office every day and work with your colleagues, what are you seeing and what are they having to deal with? Because it sounds as though there is really no let up.
I'm seeing amazing team care that is remarkable in terms of the resilience amongst many of the team providers. I'm seeing sadness in that we have lost colleagues who have made career decisions to either leave our institution or leave healthcare completely. And I see in the faces of the families for those that we're caring a sort of resignation, an appreciation that perhaps an unvaccinated person who's dying in our ICU of COVID had made decisions that they disagreed with. And yet here we are with the sad consequences of that.
Right now in Colorado, only 62% of residents are fully immunized. Governor Polis made a point about this last week, talking about the state's vaccination rate. Here he is.
Our spike is not as bad and not likely to be as bad as the Southeast spike of 2 months ago because we have a higher vaccination rate. It would be just as bad here if we didn't. Thankfully, we do.
I wonder what your response is to that, because you were saying it's almost like the impact of the vaccine has been, would you say, negligible? How could that be?
The challenge with Delta virus is that 62% is just never going to be enough to provide the kind of community-wide herd immunity that we need. Where we look to the governor's leadership is to lift the light footprint and to perhaps reinstate some of the community-wide social distancing and mask requirements that were highly effective 1 year ago. Now, that's not a replacement for immunization. It has to be our community's highest priority. And it's perhaps a little surprise that in a community that never prioritized a really substantial safety net prior to the pandemic, that we are in the situation that we are now.
Dr. Ivor Douglas, he is chief of pulmonary and critical care medicine at Denver Health and a professor at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Thank you, and we wish you the best.
Thank you for your time.
A humanitarian crisis is growing at the border between Belarus and Poland, where thousands of migrants are camped out in a frigid forest with limited food and limited heat. At least 9 people have died. European leaders say this crisis was engineered by the authoritarian leader of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko. And Matthew Chance is one of the few reporters to visit the area recently. He is CNN senior international correspondent, and he joins us from the border. Matthew, so what are you seeing? What are the conditions there now?
Well, the conditions are pretty grim, to be fair. We saw these extraordinary scenes earlier on today, where the migrant camp that had been growing over the course of the past 7 or 8 days was suddenly evacuated wholesale by the more than 2,000 people that were living in very poor conditions, sort of in that forest on the edge of the border between Belarus and Poland. Now, there'd been a rumor circulating in the camp for the previous 24 hours that the Poles, the Polish, were poised to open a humanitarian corridor to allow these refugees to go through. I don't know where that rumor came from. It may have just come from social media. It may have been put out there by the Belarusians themselves, but the refugees believed it. And so there's a real sense of disappointment when they got to that border checkpoint. And what they found awaiting them wasn't a corridor, but was razor wire, Polish border police, helicopters circling in the skies, water cannon. You know, and they're there now, you know, camped out at that border crossing, you know, hoping to get in, but there's very little sign from the Polish side that they intend to back down.
Matthew, these migrants in general, where did they come from and how did they get to this border in the first place?
Well, the majority of the people that I've spoken to over the past week have come from Iraq, from Iraqi Kurdistan. They took the opportunity that was presented to them by the Belarusian government to travel to Minsk, to be transported or to get cheap transport to the border region, because they believed, they'd been told that this was going to be a shortcut, a fast track into the European Union. But, you know, obviously they were misled, because that's not what's on offer in Belarus. What's on offer is this very bleak camp, freezing conditions, very little food, very little water, very little shelter from the Belarusian side, and an absolute rejection by the Polish side in the EU to let them in, which is, you know, it's heartbreaking, really, because you can blame whoever you like for this crisis. But the truth is, you know, they are real refugees. And it's heartbreaking to watch the small children, the mothers with, I mean, there were 200 children there and 600 women, and they're in such a terrible state. I mean, you can't help thinking, no matter who's responsible for this, you know, surely something should be done to stop people from, you know, suffering.
Matthew, for the rest of us far away, help us understand the argument that the government of Belarus orchestrated it. European leaders have blamed him for this and today agreed to impose new sanctions. What is the accusation?
Right. Well, I mean, it started back last year when Alexander Lukashenko, who's the leader of Belarus, staged fraudulent elections in the country. It led to a massive outpouring of opposition protests, which were cracked down on hard by the authorities to keep Alexander Lukashenko in power. What followed was a raft of sanctions imposed by the international community, the EU in particular, on Belarus. And the allegation is that this is Alexander Lukashenko's way of revenge. He wants to cause problems for the European Union, to show that he can fight their sanctions with this response, to put pressure on them. That's what, you know, the European allegation is.
Yeah, and very briefly, what is Lukashenko's response to this charge?
Yeah, he denies it. I mean, he says this is nonsense. In fact, he throws the allegation back and saying, actually, it's not me that's created this crisis. It's you. And he points to Polish government, the Lithuanian government, all of whom have been subject to this sort of influx of refugees.
Yeah. Now, Matthew, we have a little bit of a sound here from your reporting. You visited the migrant camp and spoke to a person named Binar, who said he's already paid $2,000 to get from Iraqi Kurdistan to Belarus. Let's take a listen.
Do you think you're going to get through? Do you think you will go to Germany?
Yes.
You do?
Yes, we are. Our people stay in here, want to go to the Germany.
Yes, but do you think it will happen?
Yeah.
You'll try?
Yes, we try. We don't want to stay in Poland.
Matthew, finally, as we hear this voice, if this continues to be a standoff and these migrants are there and winter comes and it gets colder, where does this go for them?
Yeah, no, it's a difficult question to answer. I mean, something's got to give, right? There's no way that these, I think it's something like 2,500 people now, according to the Belarusian border agency, that are in this position right on that border in an exposed position. It's already getting cold, and soon it will get much worse than that. So something has got to give. Is it going to be the European Union saying, look, we're going to bring these people in? Or is it going to be the Belarusians? Are they going to capitulate and sort of round these people up and bring them back to Minsk, or at least get some facilities in place so, you know, these people stand a chance of surviving the winter?
Matthew Chance, CNN senior international correspondent. Matthew, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Greg Martin is a born leader. He was an all-star athlete outside high school in Boston and voted most likely to succeed. He went to West Point and got hooked on the Army. He went on to Ranger and Airborne School and all the hoo-ha schools that give you instant cred. The Army saw Martin as a rising star. They sent him to MIT. He got 2 master's degrees and a PhD, and then he earned 2 more masters. Greg Martin ultimately became brigadier commander in charge of more than 10,000 soldiers. They admired him and his unyielding energy, even though he put them through round-the-clock workouts. Mad Martin, they named him. What they didn't know, and what he didn't know, is that he had bipolar disorder. Along came the Iraq War. In 2003, General Martin's brigade was part of the forward elements of the planned assault on Baghdad. It was terrifying to be in combat, but through the haze of Martin's bipolar, it was the ultimate high.
I felt exuberant. You know, I had a delusion that I was Superman and I was able to lift up off the ground and fly and see the battlefield from up above. That's pretty strange, and it probably should have been some sort of a trigger. But when you go into mania like that, you don't have any idea that you're in mania, that there's anything wrong. It just all feels wonderful.
And I think that kind of feeling, not the delusion, but that kind of feeling of complete command of a situation and excitement probably served you well as a senior officer, too.
And it did. You know, that's one of the ironies about bipolar disorder. My levels of energy, positivity, creativity were just way above my fellow commanders. Nobody can keep up with you. And so you're rewarded. You have a biochemical advantage over everybody else. You're solving problems faster. It's wonderful until you go too high and then you become destructive and a problem, or until you've crashed into depression.
And which happened to you?
After the attack was over, and that took about 3 weeks, I was still on a high for several more weeks. And then when we settled down into these forward operating bases, which were big base camps, then I fell into depression. It was really debilitating, but I would force myself to get out in front of the soldiers and do physical training with them. And once I did that, I would lift up out of the depression and I would be good for most of the day. But eventually I started rapid cycling in Iraq, which means you're going from depression into mania, back into depression, and maybe into mania again, all in the same day.
Were you aware of what was happening at the time?
No, I didn't have any idea that there was anything wrong with me.
Did anybody approach you, any of those under your command or above?
It turns out lots of people in retrospect, because I've gone back and interviewed many of my subordinates and seniors and said, hey, you know, I found out in 2014, I had bipolar. Did you see any indication of that? And then subordinates started saying, you know, now that you mention it, I did see stuff. Your energy was over the top. You weren't getting enough sleep. You know, you were doing PT all hours of the day and night. You know, you would have flight of ideas. You'd have so many ideas, you couldn't keep track of the ideas. Your speech got very rapid and pressurized. You got paranoia. You started mistrusting certain people when it made no sense. Another thing, they said, you know, you took excessive risks on the battlefield. You were too aggressive. You put yourself and your force protection guys at risk because you wanted to go everywhere, see everything on the battlefield. And they said, you should have backed that off significantly.
That's also incredibly frightening, I would think, not just for you, but also for those who were under your command, because you were potentially hurting everybody there. Maybe it was lost on you then, but it's not now. So despite this, you were elevated to the rank of major general, and then you became president of the nation's highest military educational institution, National Defense University. So the bipolar disorder, undiagnosed, didn't stop you.
Not only did it not stop me, I think it helped me until it stopped helping me. I went acutely manic, and then I was in acute depression. I should not have been in the military. I shouldn't have been leading. I shouldn't have had access to a clearance. I shouldn't have had access to weapons. That would have been a danger and a liability. So almost for 2 years, I probably took a dozen, 15 medications. None of them did a thing. And the doctor prescribed lithium, which is a natural salt. It's Li3 on the chemical periodical tables. And within about a few days, I started feeling good. I was my old self after a week. Lisa, I had to want to get better. I had to believe I could get better. And then I had to work closely, hand in hand, with my doctors. And I'm doing great. Now, the bipolar is with me for life. I can't take a day off because bipolar can come back and kick my butt anytime it wants to.
So you're doing due diligence to your own health. I wonder if the military fell down in its responsibility to take care of your health and presumably the health, the mental health issues facing other senior leaders and those lower in the chain of command. I mean, there was one quote from Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, former U.S. National Security Advisor, and he says in part, "The traits that obscure bipolar and other disorders are prevalent in leaders. If these disorders go untreated, they can lead to behavior harmful to those leaders and others." And you've spoken about that dangerous behavior. But here's the question. Before the disorders can get treated, they have to be diagnosed. And in your case, and presumably many others, there's something preventing that from happening in the military. What is your understanding of what it is?
I think we have a military culture that derives great strength and power from respect for the chain of command, fighting for your commander, but it's a double-edged sword. When you have a real serious problem, which by everything I read, mental health problems are growing, the double-edged sword is we haven't figured out how to have subordinates who are going to be the first ones to see and detect a mental health problem. We haven't figured out a way for them to have an avenue to express it and to get somebody in a position of responsibility and authority to get the mental health challenged person into medical channels for diagnosis.
What are the stakes here in the bigger picture? What's the effect in aggregate on the U.S. military and on those serving in the military?
I would say that the essence of the military is to take these wonderful young men and women who enlist and join the service and train them so they are really ready to go deploy, fight, win decisively, and they come home healthy to their families. Well, the more people with mental illness that are in that cohort of soldiers, you're going to weaken the fabric, you're going to weaken the trust. Some of them are going to be a threat to themselves and commit suicide or attempted suicide, which is a terrible epidemic as it is. And some of them are going to turn their weapons and their violence on others, their fellow service members. So to that extent, it tears at the fabric and the morale of the units, the warfighting units, and it degrades the capability to perform. I also think that bipolar and many or most of these mental health conditions are treatable medical conditions if diagnosed and the proper medical steps are taken. That's the good news.
What is your wish? It sounds like your life is going really well. As you said, you'll have bipolar for the rest of your life, but you're thriving and you're happy and productive. And you said more humble, you have more humility than you did before. What do you want to accomplish with speaking out and writing the book?
We got to get past this taboo, stigma, spooky, medieval, weird stuff that I think pollutes and distorts the reality of mental illness. I mean, believe me, I was completely healthy. And, you know, it's not some like demon flying around in my brain that gave me the mental illness. It's something physically happened. It was a physiological phenomenon that created the excess biochemicals in the distribution that caused me to, you know, go into mania and then depression. So that's what I want. And I want to help. I want to be a player and, you know, go speak and talk. And you've given me a fabulous opportunity, Lisa. I really appreciate it. Hopefully it'll do some good. And that's what I want to do. It's my life mission to, you know, share my bipolar story, to help save lives and stop the stigma. I mean, that's it. And I'll do it through speaking, through writing, through going on conferences and on panels and all that sort of thing.
I think you're going to help a lot of people, and I appreciate you speaking to us and spreading the word. Major General Greg Martin, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
Today, millions of parents will receive another payment from the government. It's the Enhanced Child Tax Credit, part of the COVID response bill passed in March. But the future of this program is iffy. There is one last monthly payment guaranteed in December, and then it's up to Congress to decide what's next. Let's talk to Jill Schlesinger, business analyst at CBS News and the host of Jill on Money. And Jill, the Enhanced Child Credit, these payments have been going to millions of parents every month since July. How important has this money been in this crazy time?
Well, I mean, considering that we're talking about, according to the Treasury, 77 million folks here, this is a lot. And, you know, what's been fascinating is to hear the discussion around how these payments have lifted so many out of poverty. Child poverty, a chronic issue in the United States. And Columbia University recently had an estimate that this child tax credit could cut child poverty by 45%, with the largest impacts on Latino and Black children. That's why it's really stayed in focus as something that could be extended potentially. We'll have to wait and see, but that it could really have a meaningful impact.
All right. And before we get into Congress and what's next, let's just be clear on what this current program is. It is complicated. There are these monthly payments that add up to half of the total credit these families get. How did they get the rest?
Well, they can either get the rest in a lump sum or at tax time, or they can get it now. And the thing that's been kind of funky about this is that because it's sort of weirdly complicated, there is some fear that not enough people are getting it, although many of the people are sort of automatically in the payment. So there's something that's important in here because there is, you can, non-filer families can continue to sign up to get these payments, but that's through today. And so there is a tool that's available, but it's going away after today. And I hesitate to say that there's like this deadline and we must act now, because basically you'll be able to get the other half if you file your taxes.
Yeah. Okay. And this isn't the only pandemic bill benefit that is starting to run out. Student loan payments, for instance, are scheduled to start back in January. Is there a broader signal here that enhanced government support may be starting to slow down or end?
Well, I mean, it is absolutely doing that. And I think on purpose, right? You know, we know that the pandemic relief was an emergency measure, a temporary measure. And so when we think about the student loan forbearance for federal student loans, the clock is going to start ticking again in January. But I think that there is some good news here because so many students are now going to be really focused on paying this down before the interest rates start popping up again. A lot of people are employed. And don't forget, you know, we do have a very strong labor market. Wages are increasing. I know that we're contending with higher inflation, but especially those at the lower end of the income stream seem to be keeping pace with inflation pretty well. So far, so good.
And very quickly, what could Congress do to extend this increased child care tax credit?
Well, this could possibly be extended through the Build Back Better plan. I think that there are a lot of advocates who believe that this is a very strong program, especially because it's child focused. We'll see if it makes it in the final bill. Who knows if that bill actually comes to fruition, but it is alive and well, and hopefully, I think according to economists, they'd really like to see this one get in.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst at CBS News and the host of Jill on Money. Jill, thank you as always.
Take care.
Today, President Biden signs into law a generational investment in the country's infrastructure. That means north of $1 trillion for water pipes, rural broadband, the power grid, passenger and freight rail, and yes, roads and bridges. So now the conversation moves from politicking to implementing. And with us to talk about that is the Transportation Commissioner of Minnesota, Margaret Anderson Kelleher. She's a Democrat. Commissioner, welcome.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me today.
Minnesota stands to receive nearly $7 billion here after the money flows through the federal agencies and the states put up matching funds. Put this amount of money into context for Minnesotans. How might this change their lives?
Well, I think it is definitely the largest investment we have seen from the federal government in infrastructure in a very long time, and particularly with where it's focused on safety, climate, and equity. We have 11 federally recognized tribal governments in Minnesota. And so working with those tribal governments on their plans for this federal money that meets the goals that they have, which include things like job equity, as well as trying to mitigate climate change. We've seen heavier rains, warmer temperatures, both in winter and summer. So things like upgrading culvert size to be able to handle the rains that might come. But we're also looking at these issues around how do we produce less greenhouse gases? These are all things that we're working on.
I understand one of the pressing needs is a bridge that connects Duluth, Minnesota to Superior, Wisconsin. What does this bridge need, and will you have the resources as a result of this bill?
So it's called the Blatnik Bridge, and we're going through the process right now to determine whether it's a rehabilitation project or a complete rebuild. I can't say for sure that the IIJA bill is going to be able to totally take us out of the woods on funding this project. What we do know is the $300 million in the bill already for bridges that's going to come directly to a state like Minnesota. And there's other funding in the bill that is going to be application-based for major bridges as well as very large projects. So I'm hopeful that a combination of state funds as well as federal funds can deliver this bridge in the next decade. But right now, it's a little early to see that. We do actually have another project up in the Duluth area that's the important lead into this project called the Twin Ports Interchange. It's not a safe section of highway for a lot of people. People tell us they don't really love driving it. So this project will improve the safety, the ability to also move freight off of the Port of Duluth into the rest of the state and the upper Midwest and beyond. We had to split that project into four chapters. And we've been doing chapter one and chapter two right now. We're going to be able to move that project completely back together and being able to deliver it over the next few years here. We believe that will be a high priority.
Yeah. Let's talk about rail. I understand there is a federal rail plan proposal to connect the Twin Cities to Chicago by high-speed rail. As you think about priorities, how important might this project be, and would there potentially be funding from this bill for that?
Yeah, so that's an exciting project. We call it the second train to Chicago because we do have the Empire Builder train that comes across from the West Coast all the way across the Midwest down to Chicago. And that that train runs once a day. And so it doesn't do a complete loop. So this will create a second train, which creates that daily loop. And that train will originate in St. Paul and go to Chicago. We actually believe that we have largely gotten that project underway, but it is very helpful to know that the historic investment in passenger rail can help us on that project. There's also a project called the Northern Lights Express, Minneapolis to Duluth. And we are interested in having that project move forward further.
Given new technology, given the carbon footprints that we know about, where do you see funding in transit, in electric vehicle charging stations, in rail, that can actually innovate, that can change how people get around in Minnesota in 2030, 2040, 2050?
There's no doubt. We did a report a couple of years ago called Decarbonizing the Transportation Sector. There's sort of this whole category of future mobility that's probably, you know, 30 to 50 years down the road that will look very different, I think. And so that includes, you know, possibly electrification of small fleet flying taxis. It could include, you know, smaller and different autonomous vehicles. We have a project going right now in Rochester, Minnesota called the MedCity Mover. So in Rochester, the MedCity Mover will be in place for a year. It's a small, connected, automated electric vehicle. And it's really a research project to understand what are people's attitudes about this vehicle before they get in it, and then what's their experience like. And it's doing a loop from the Mayo Clinic to an important area where there's both groceries and food available for people. But I went down and wrote it recently with the mayor of Rochester, Kim Norton, and we're very excited about what we're going to learn there about the future.
That's Margaret Anderson Kelleher. She is Transportation Commissioner of the state of Minnesota. Commissioner, thanks for the time.
Thanks so much, Scott.
Now the latest in gopher news. In the past couple of years, researchers have discovered that a handful of mammals glow under black lights. Flying squirrels, wombats, platypuses light up in bright pinks, blues, and greens. Looks like they can add to the list pocket gophers. Molly Samuel from member station WABE reports.
J.T. Pine was a biology graduate student at the University of Georgia a few years ago when he learned that flying squirrels glow neon pink under black lights. So he decided to shine a UV flashlight on some of the animals he studies, and the southeastern pocket gophers lit up.
It's kind of an indescribable blend of purple and blue and pink. It's very, very psychedelic.
The southeastern pocket gopher is a burrowing rodent that spends most of its life underground in the tunnels it digs in Georgia, Alabama, and Florida. Pine checked a few other gopher species from other parts of the country, too, and they also glow. His paper describing the glowing gophers was recently published in the scientific journal The American Midland Naturalist. He says he was excited to make the discovery, but he doesn't know why it happens.
It could be diet-related, where they eat all of these compounds and then the compounds get digested and then end up in their skin and fur.
Or it could have evolved as some form of communication among gophers, or camouflage from predators, or
it's possible that it doesn't mean anything.
Allie Kohler is a grad student at Colorado State University, and she was one of the people who discovered that flying squirrels glow pink under black lights. She says there's no answer yet for why any mammals glow, but she's enjoyed seeing glowing mammal discoveries add up since her flying squirrel research was published a couple of years ago. Some plants, birds, arthropods, amphibians, and fish are biofluorescent, too.
If you're swimming around in the water, there are reasons to have fluorescence. It's a lot easier in the water to come up with a plausible scenario.
University of Kansas professor Leo Smith has studied evolution and biofluorescence. He says it's easier to imagine why sea creatures would glow because of how light travels underwater.
It's harder to figure out why they would do it on land.
But he says there do appear to be similarities with the mammals. Most of them are nocturnal or live in low-light situations. J.T. Pine, who's now a biologist at the Georgia Wildlife Federation, says he's happy that his beloved pocket gophers are part of this fluorescent club.
I've always described them as really angry russet potatoes. But now they're really angry russet potatoes that glow.
He says the more biofluorescent mammals that get discovered, the closer scientists might get to figuring out why they do it, though they may also just raise more questions. For Here and Now, I'm Molly Samuel.
Thanksgiving is next week, and the pandemic is still with us. This year, though, vaccines have made travel and gatherings safer for most people, and that could make for a busier holiday travel season for the airline industry. Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan has his eye on planes and trains and, like, everything else. Seth, yesterday, the Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, reported screening more than 2.1 million travelers. That's about 90% of the number reported on the same date 2 years ago. Does this mean we're back to pre-pandemic numbers of people flying?
Well, at least I guess it means we're back to 90% at least, right? And yeah, these numbers are very similar to what we used to see. And what you have to remember, too, is that these airlines are struggling now from a staffing perspective. And so demand is very much back to what it once was. It's just that they're not capable of flying as much as they were a couple of years ago. But looking at airline schedules, according to Cirium data, oh, they're up 42% from last Thanksgiving and down just 6% in terms of the number of domestic airlines have scheduled compared to two Thanksgivings ago.
So what about those staffing levels? I mean, just recently we saw Southwest and American canceling hundreds of flights because of staff shortages. The numbers of flyers are up. Are the numbers of staffers sufficiently down to cause problems?
Well, these airlines are starting to get their hands around it in terms of at least more proactively canceling flights ahead of time. So, you know, do they have the number of staff that they need to really meet all of the demand out there? Quite clearly not. What's beginning to happen, though, is that instead of running into situations like what Southwest and American both had, as you said, they're just canceling the flights further in advance. So you might get that notification that, hey, your flight next week, forget about it. You're not on a different flight, and that's inconvenient, but not as bad as what those people experienced in recent months. And for the longer term, these airlines are hiring. They have training classes going right now, but that doesn't help for Thanksgiving in many cases for the winter holidays either.
And what about passengers? What are they telling you about how they're preparing to navigate the rush? Any tips from them or from you?
Well, passengers are of course aware of these things because we've all seen what's going on in the news. Passengers go to the airport knowing that there might be some challenges. And in terms of what they can do, the people who come out best are those that are sort of creative and proactive in terms of telling the airline how the airline can help you. I said the airlines are being proactive about canceling flights, but you can be proactive too, Lisa. You know, if you see your flight is canceled, if you don't mind going to a different airport, that sort of thing. Let the airline know that. You know, they're going to look for the next seat to the same destination that you were flying. If you're supposed to fly to Fort Lauderdale, they're going to look for that next seat to Fort Lauderdale. If you don't mind flying to Miami or West Palm Beach instead, tell them that. They won't assume it, and it could get you there more quickly than if you waited to go to your original destination. And it helps not to pack heavy if you can avoid it. Not only does that save you money these days with most airlines, not checking bags, but if you have to kind of run for a different flight, run for that Miami flight instead of a Fort Lauderdale flight, if you didn't check a bag, a lot of times it's a lot easier to reroute just you running across the terminal than your bag as well.
Now, there's one other thing that airlines have had to deal with, and that is unruly passengers. And last week, the FAA fined 10 people a total of more than $200,000 for violent behavior on planes. Have the airlines been preparing for more incidents like this as more people decide to board more planes?
They have, and airlines are handling it in different ways. Delta actually proposed having sort of an industry-wide no-fly list, almost like what you have for other kinds of incidents. You know, people who are on a terrorism watch list. They're saying just because you're kicked off of Delta, well, if you have that same proclivity to flight attendants, you probably shouldn't be able to fly American or United too, because right now you could have something go wrong and obviously still fly a lot of airlines before you run out of airlines to fly. But yeah, this is something that's clearly on the rise. Always difficult, Lisa, to separate the perception from the reality, you know, what's in the media from what might have happened anyway, right? We're also probably just hearing more about this because of sensitivities, but little doubt that at least to some extent, we are indeed having more of these incidents, people confronting flight crew and gate agents, and these airlines are pretty serious about doing something about that.
Right. A few videos go a long way. And one other question in terms of the airlines, it strikes me that since a lot of people haven't been flying for a while, this could be potentially a really good opportunity for airlines to lure people back or maybe to ward them off forever, depending on your experience when you fly.
Absolutely. I know for me, for example, a sample size of just one, but I'm traveling this Thanksgiving. I didn't travel last Thanksgiving, right? And there are a lot of people like that who are almost, it is as first-time flyers of the pandemic era, people who used to travel a lot, and that's very true. And fares right now are rather high. That's one thing, you know, related to these staffing shortages. In the end, Lisa, supply and demand economics, these are airlines that have taken some flights out, and with just about as many people wanting to fly as you might have had 2 years ago, but not as many flights, not as many seats. It's pushing up the cost of air travel.
Seth Kaplan, Here and Now transportation analyst. Thanks, Seth.
Thanks, Lisa.
If you plan to spend time with family and friends this holiday season, you may be thinking about difficult conversations you may have on vaccines, masks, mandates, and more. If you have questions about this second Thanksgiving during the pandemic and how to navigate it, Washington Post advice columnist Carolyn Hacks will answer some of them. You can tweet us at Here and Now. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now.